The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Sean Fanning, the talent manager at Improbable. Sean, thanks so much for coming on the show, mate. Really appreciate the time. I want to get stuck straight in, actually, and talk a little bit about the talent market at the moment. I think it's a particular... I don't know whether it's unprecedented. Probably, I'm sure it's not. But the way that kind of technical talent and the market is going, it seems like really unprecedented in that we have such a shortage and such a skill gap that's been built up in such a kind of a short period of time that I can't really think, and I'm by no means a historian or an economic historian on this, but I can't really think of a time where it's happened so quickly. And it's an interesting one because it puts people such as yourself in such a unique position and probably stretches the role to have to be so much more creative, and I'm sure far different than perhaps when you kind of initially started in kind of the recruitment space.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, I've been in the recruiting space since 2011, and the landscape, especially in London, has moved from one where the top of the pile was, your tier one investment banks, your hedge funds, and sort of when the kind of Silicon Valley companies were starting to land, to a landscape now where it's almost reverse. People are shunning these traditional employers in the favor of startups, in the favor of larger organizations from Silicon Valley, and mm-hmm. and also starting themselves up. So you see programs like Entrepreneur First has done some really interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. Accelerators are popping up. Campuses are popping up. So, I'd say certainly the market has kind of shifted, and ultimately, I think there has been a bit of a fear of missing out when it comes to technical kind of staff, mm-hmm. right? So it's large businesses and more traditional businesses are employing staff without necessarily having a 10-year plan in mind, mm-hmm. right? Everyone's using data analytics to understand their stuff, maybe we should do that, and what that means is you get a lot of people being sort of employed in more traditional companies in in technology roles, which means that it further stretches out the kind of market.
Yeah. It's interesting, and I'm specifically referring to you and the areas that you've had to mm-hmm. pay attention to. What has that meant for your kind of, for someone in your position and the pressures that's been added on you to kind of go above and beyond the role? Is there a skill set involved there that, like I mentioned earlier, that perhaps you never expected to kind of tap into?
I think certainly, right? You have to be very, as the startup ecosystem goes, and there's a lot of people doing a lot of different things, mm-hmm. you have to be, we've are certainly broadened my skill set to understand the mm-hmm. marketplace a bit better, understand competitors, understand them from a value proposition, from a how they talk about themselves, how they define their roles, how they what they're looking to build as well. So you have to somewhat have this it's competitive intelligence aspect to the role. If you're going to provide real value as a, an internal recruiting resource, right? You need to be able to say, X and Y, have merged and, their share price is now, below their last raise. Therefore, anybody with, equity or stock units is likely to be, disgruntled, right? You have to use a bit more kind of, nous and market intelligence to inform your hire. Yeah. The same goes for when you're sort of starting out to build you know, new offices or new teams, you know, the temptation is always to just jump to who's looking rather than a more informed way of building things.
And, you know, you kind of mentioned there, actually, interestingly enough, about your kind of approach to market and what comes to mind, incentivizing people, obviously working in an internal role now. Incentivizing people, incentivizing tech people who are in, you know, vastly high demand at the moment. That seems to have clearly shifted the way that businesses are approaching, you know, talent and looking after their talent. I find it really fascinating, you know, the obviously, I think, was it Google or Facebook that kind of, I guess you could probably say, really innovated the office space and took that to a new level. But you know, in your opinion, are, you know, ping pong tables and slides in the middle of the office, you know, is that all part of it, or is it kind of a marketing ploy? And do we still have to focus on the substance?
I would say ping pong tables are often the hallmark of people who don't think critically about culture or their values. So right. Culture is a company culture is a, to me, feels like an evolving thing, right? Certainly in my experience with, you know, with Improbable, it's evolved over time as we've explored new markets. You take on diverse, you know, perspectives, and you frankly grow up a bit, you know, as your company goes from, you know, goes and grows and makes mistakes and learns from. I think the more important thing for people to focus on is their values. So what is it, you know, what are the core kind of behaviors and values, you know, we want in our employees and, you know, why do we want them? So, you know, some people are look very kind of mission driven, you know, get stuff done attitude, and they're willing to say that is to the detriment of, you know, deep levels of empathy. It's frankly up to the leadership of the company as to, you know, how they want to do that. But if you think first about values, you know, what are the things you want to anchor your company around? It becomes a lot easier to interview for that, right? And be constantly referring to, you know, those values. And, you know, the famous case of people that did this very well is Amazon and their leadership principles. You know, they have, I think it's 13 or 15, and everybody that's interviewed gets, you know, questions aligned to the behaviors most important to that role. And that allows you to, you know, really create, you know, a kind of a sense of unified, kind of a sense of unification around the company, right? And different companies and, you know, different scenarios demand these different things. And it's, you know, ultimately it's up to the founders or, you know, the leadership to appreciate what they want. But I think, you know, it sounds kind of funny to say, because I do sit in an office that does have a ping pong table, you know, a pool table and nice surroundings. But we're confident that we have taken the extra time to ensure that people are aligned to our values and they want to be here for this job rather than just a job. And if you can do that, and if you can really put emphasis into the hiring aspect, then you can have a company where the default position from leadership to employees and from employees to employees is a default position of trust rather than some, you know, hierarchical political sort of environment that people find unpleasant. And ultimately, pool tables, beers on a Friday, nice terrace, that kind of thing, they can often just be people do that because everyone else is doing it.
Yeah.
It just seems a done thing in that sense. If people are joining because you've got a pool table, then it's you've either got
good pool player on your hands.
Or you haven't really found dug in enough to understand what really motivates that person. Yeah. And if you don't understand that, how are you going to be able to retain that person? Right. So I think gimmicks like that, it's nice to have, but it's that's not culture. That is, it is right now. It feels like people are doing it, you know, because everyone else is doing it, right? You know, it seems to me that startups, especially ones that want to compete, they see themselves in the kind of lens of other successful companies. They just simply try and emulate, and which is fine, but they need to understand that the people that really successfully build businesses and the people that you can trust to build businesses, they're not interested in pool tables, right? They're interested in how they can grow, what opportunities they have, the impact they can have, right? People shouldn't join for pool tables. They should join for their growth, really, especially in referencing probably earlier stage kind of a startup.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, like you say, you know better than anyone what kind of the people value, you know, especially tech people. I mean, part of that growth and development is such a key part now because they have to do that in order to stay relevant almost, right? So if they're going to an environment where they may get paid more and they may have whatever pool table, etc., versus an environment that may not have them, it doesn't, you know, it's a cover-up job, isn't it? Because essentially they have to think long term. And seems to me
it's much more expensive to lose people, have a high attrition rate, because you think that a ping pong table is going to mask the fact that, you know, you're not providing for a long term.
Yeah.
Long term.
They clearly had to shift that responsibility and invest in that kind of development. But I find it interesting from someone in your position, because like you were talking about hiring for values and such, it's actually quite difficult to do that, right? I mean, I know as a marketing director, most of what we do is obviously directly quantifiable in terms of sales and revenue, right? But there is a big area of it that may not be the easiest thing to necessarily quantify. So I can relate to somewhat where you're kind of go into a meeting of whatever sort, and you're trying to put together a strategy for attraction and then potentially, more importantly, retention of staff, mm-hmm. right? And you're sat there going, well, we need to look at investing in this, that, and the other. And sometimes I always think it must be really difficult for someone in that position, because it's not always the easiest thing to kind of directly quantify on, like, what behaviors and what cultural changes need to be put in place in order to achieve things like that. So I find it really difficult. So I'd be interested to kind of hear about, you know, how you kind of try to approach and overcome things like that.
So there's traditional kind of techniques around behavioral interviewing, where you ask a structured set of questions about people's experience from the past, and you really go very deep on specific examples that are tied to a behavior, right? So if you think about, you're a startup and you know that you're kind of finding your way in the world, the most important thing for you right now is the ability to work in ambiguity and get stuff done, right? Those could be two behaviors you want to see. There's a lot of good resource out there about behavioral interviewing, and find it very, very kind of useful as a tool. And again, we're, you know, by no means any doing anything kind of radically new. This is all kind of stuff that's kind of been around for a while, but it makes the most impact when you're able to tie it to what are the behaviors that's going to make someone successful in this role? Because you can have a lot of different roles. You know, something like, you know, software engineering manager is, you know, you're going to probably want them to spike on empathy and, you know, essentially their ability to grow others. So you want to look at experiences of direct experiences from their past. Someone in account management or sales might be, you want to understand their behaviors of dealing with difficult customers or, you know, sharing knowledge. So I think it's all too easy to just, I think a lot of people are focused a lot on defining the role, but they're not defining success in the role. And if you don't define what success is likely to look like, then how can you know that you find someone that is likely to be successful?
And there's an art in itself, I think, especially with regards to kind of the interviewing. And there's a lot of, I think people are trying to crack the code. You know, you hear about technologies, maybe like automated technologies, AI and such that people are considering for like acquiring talent. And interestingly enough, I find it still to be one space that I just struggle to see beyond someone like yourself who's just experienced and is talented at what they do to kind of solve the problem. And I think it's the people and, you know, getting really embedded into the culture that really matters above a lot of other things that you can't quantify. And again, it seems quite fluffy to say something like that, but I believe that there's a massive amount of truth in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we have seen a lot of technologies that really are kind of focused at the top end of the funnel, let's say. So they might do, you know, automated CV screening or create, a video sort of platform that allows people to go a bit further in their CV, let's say, or that kind of stuff. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, the output is still something that is then analyzed by a professional, someone that knows, can spot patterns and use their own inference from their experience to say, this, I think this, or this person, you know, she looks like a great candidate for these reasons. And then subsequently, when you get into the interview loops, then it becomes, especially if you're serious about hiring for values and specifically understanding people's experience, you know, it's pretty difficult to do in an automated way. I think the more focus there is on solely on hard technical skills, and hard technical skills essentially is how easy can we quantify something in a binary scale, the more likely it is that automation can play a part. Really, as soon as there is a need to kind of bring the human element in, right? And ultimately, it's fundamentally, people should be thinking about, is this not someone I tick off against a hiring requirement, is my company is going to invest time and resources into this person. By hiring them, are we setting them up for success?
Absolutely, mate. And do you find that when you take that kind of approach to it, it's easy to kind of relay that message because it comes across the desk when you are trying to acquire talent, the sincerity of everything, and when you kind of internally diagnose the problem and committed to a vision with regards to talent, do you find that it's easier then to kind of relay that message when attracting, you know, talent in such a, you know, when we have such a shortage of it in this marketplace, you know, how important do you think they can kind of sniff it out because they're in such demand?
It's interesting. It's not everyone's going to agree with it. And certainly, you know, there are times where, you know, it can be frustrating, right? Because you have someone with the right, you know, technical chops, you know, to join, but perhaps he or she isn't aligned to, you know, the longer term, right, of your business, and, you know, perhaps would be better off, you know, elsewhere. And sometimes people, you know, are not really, don't necessarily understand why that is. And it can be, you know, it can be, there is always this temptation to say, well, let's see how it goes, right? But very often those are the most dangerous hires you can make, especially early on in a startup. You think of just the political imbalancing when, you know, you get someone who is, you know, not aligned to, you know, what the company's trying to achieve and so on. Like, you know, a bad hire can be so disruptive that, you know, the trade-off for, you know, waiting for the next right candidate, you know, is, it can often be tempting, especially because, you know, at early stage, people often equate, you know, the faster we can hire, the faster we can succeed, you know, we can beat the competition, et cetera, et cetera. But actually it can be, you know, counterproductive.
It's really interesting, actually, because it's just kind of a similar theory. I think a lot of kind of service industries actually are facing, it's not obviously directly, but it's comparable in that what we're doing is almost like bending over backwards. And because we know that there's kind of a skill shortage there, it's like anyone who kind of fits the bill, it's like, what can we do? You know, what can we do to kind of bring you on? And actually, you know, in a sense, what you're saying is that you're kind of flipping it on its head and staying true and saying, although this is, you know, which obviously takes a lot of discipline in a kind of skill shortage environment, but saying, no, we know what we're about. We know what our value is. And essentially, you know, you might be incredibly talented and we are in a skill shortage market, but we're not kind of budging and we're being extremely disciplined. It's so true because I think and a really intelligent way of doing it, but yet incredibly difficult to execute on, because you see it time and time again, you know, from my experiences working in tech organizations as well. It's mm-hmm. I've seen it so many times where you get these people in and they can just be such a misfit, and it causes way more problems than it's worth. And it all comes down to this kind of attraction piece, and it's happening a lot because of the skill shortage. So taking the approach that you just mentioned is a very interesting, but I think intelligent way of approaching kind of the, you know, skill shortage market. It's actually, you know, still being disciplined. Yeah, interesting. And I think obviously it's easier for some, obviously it goes without saying, you know, if you have a strong brand, you know, good reputation in the marketplace, mm-hmm. etc., it's obviously easier to acquire talent. But I also think that that's good because it kind of pushes the bar higher on, you know, level of quality of service as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the point to this is there has to be buy-in across the board, you know, from the entire, you know, leadership to, you know, really kind of reinforce that this is the way that we want to hire, and tie it to a, you know, an outcome, right? Ultimately, startups are optimizing for getting to, you know, sustainable revenue, let's say, mm-hmm. In a shorter time with as few resources as possible, right? And that makes a lot of sense. But how can they do that if they're essentially introducing risk by not being completely, I guess, ruthless in their hiring, that sort of thing, you know? And I think it all comes down to, you know, sometimes a lot of people have this estimation that they are the best interviewers, you know, I know what's best for X, Y, and Z. They believe that they're, you know, like everyone thinks that they're a great driver. You know, ultimately there's a lot more that comes into it, and unless people have, you know, hired hundreds and hundreds of or thousands of people, it is unlikely that you know, they're gonna kind of really spend as the right level of focus on kind of hiring, you know. And you know, if you look at all the various blogs from VCs and you know, founders in Silicon Valley, you know, what you really see is that they come to this conclusion that actually, you know, the most important thing you can do as a founder in the early days is hire the right staff and hire the right team. You know, it's not jump headlong into product development and so on. It's a bit, you know, making sure you've got all the track laid before you, you know, start the train, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Or at least some of the track, let's say.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's going to continue in a similar direction for a long time. But it's interesting that, you know, obviously within tech, it seems to be kind of pushing the bar in all the disciplines as well, and including kind of talent. And, you know, in tech, it's very difficult to kind of forecast what areas and what skill shortages there's going to be. But within regards to talent as well, the problem doesn't seem like it's necessarily going to go away. So, you know, as far as the innovation piece, and it doesn't necessarily mean with regards to technology, but as far as automating processes and continuing to improve those processes, mm-hmm. is that something that, you know, you kind of proactively doing to try and kind of constantly improve? Do you go to meetups, etc.? Is it something that you're, how do you kind of approach that to stay on top of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you should never be kind of isolated from what the market is doing, what your competitors are doing, you know. You know, your own candidates are a great source of feedback, right? You know, how was our process? You know, how would you improve it? You know, spend a lot of time, you know, chatting to people in the kind of the London, you know, peers in London, sort of, and well, UK kind of startups and, you know, other larger companies. And ultimately, you've got to treat it as a continually evolving process. You know, what was right for us 4 years ago is not necessarily right for us now, you know. And I think that's the same as any kind of product iteration. If you think about, you know, hiring as a product and you're, you know, at the start, you just cobble things together that get the job done, and as it grows and grows and grows and you've got more dependencies, you know, you really have to think about the changes that you make, you think about the assumptions you have, you know, you challenge them internally, you challenge them with the market, and essentially feedback, right? It's a similar kind of lean MVP style aspect of product development.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, a lot of people kind of adopting that model. I think there's clearly a lot to be said for that. We, interestingly enough, had like a qualified Scrum Master in the office yesterday working with our teams. It's really, really fascinating. As far as your kind of own personal development and vision as well, then, is there like a higher level vision, and how do you approach kind of goal setting on a personal level?
With regards to what, sorry, like goal setting for recruiting or goal setting for processes?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's kind of an open-ended question, really. I mean, as far as yourself, you know, career can be a career progression. It can just be, you know, behaviors, change, whatever it is. How do you kind of, in your own mind and, you know, towards, I suppose, your career and your bettering yourself, is there, it's always interesting, I find, to ask
about that. I'd say my career today, you know, I've been very fortunate. I joined a very small sort of recruitment agency with just two founders who had spun off from a larger organization, had some, you know, high quality clients to get my teeth stuck into, and began to work with a lot of very interesting sort of customers. And indeed, in Probable, where I work now, was kind of one of our very early customers when there were sort of four or so people. And actually, you know, I got to know the business very well, and was asked to, you know, a year later or so to come over to help sort of scale it. So in that sense, I've been very fortunate in that I've never really had to kind of, well, I never really, you know, thought critically and coherently about career prospects at that point. At that point, it was, this company has the ambition to do something, you know, truly groundbreaking, and you know, if I can be a part of that, I'm pretty sure it's going to give me the opportunities, you know, that I'm seeking. And you know, to be clear, that has happened, and you know, and even more so. So I think in terms of personal kind of goal setting, that sort of things, it's about the experience I'm getting now from going from, you know, 20 odd people to 300 where we are, and thousands where we want to get to. You know, it's shown me a lot of really interesting kind of scenarios and learnings to kind of take away. And I think, you know, when we translate that to setting goals for my team, and you know, thinking about working with the division that I work with, it's not necessarily about individual headcount and creating these very sort of defined structures. I think you have to basically understand, like, what are the capabilities that we need to build for ourselves to be successful, and how can we fill those at the same rate as our product development and business development pipeline grows, right? And how can we be essentially a party at the top table of strategic planning, you know? And a lot of that is being able to give precise, you know, estimates and data around what could or might happen. Another is to, you know, try and mitigate risks and be very actively, you know, on the ground with hiring managers, with, you know, with the team, and try and understand, you know, what might come down the pipeline before it actually does.
Awesome, mate. Sean, it's been a pleasure, mate. I think we're right on the nose at about half an hour there, so good on time. Thank you, mate. Appreciate it, and really, really enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. I hope that's...
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.